Welcome, everyone. You are listening to Forged in Fire, where we explore how LGBTQ+ leaders develop their leadership superpowers. You'll hear from guests as they share how they navigated their journey through adverse and crucible experiences to develop into amazing leaders. Forged in Fire is hosted by Lieutenant Colonel Bree Fram and Dr. Liz Cavallaro.
Hi, I'm Lieutenant Colonel Bree Fram. I'm an astronautical engineer in the United States Space Force and one of the senior transgender officers in the military. I'm a passionate advocate for the value inclusion brings to organizations.
And I'm Dr. Liz Cavallaro. I'm an adult development scholar and associate professor at the U.S. Naval War College. I'm also an experienced researcher, interviewer, leader development practitioner, and professional executive coach. Please join us as we discover the inspiring stories of how LGBTQ+ leaders are forged.
Welcome to Forged in Fire. Today, we're honored to be joined by Representative Brianna Titone. She was elected in 2018 to represent Colorado House District 27 and is currently serving her third term in office. She was also elected as co-chair of the House Majority Caucus and chair of the Colorado Democratic LGBTQ+ Caucus. She is the first openly transgender legislator in the Colorado General Assembly and the first transgender legislator in the nation elected by peers to a leadership position. Brianna utilizes her background in geochemistry, software development, and LGBTQ+ advocacy to successfully legislate an agenda committed to safety, health, prosperity, and equity. This session, she sponsored protections for accessing reproductive health care to protect and advance reproductive rights. Her legislative priorities reflect her commitment to representing her district and uplifting communities suffering from a lack of access to proper health care or protections from violence. She is an inspirational leader and a joy to speak with. Brianna, thanks so much for joining us.
Pleasure to be with you today. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Brianna. One of the many things that we've found inspirational about you and your work is the empathy that you bring to the relationships with your colleagues. And there have been multiple stories where you, despite working with those who may not understand you and may not provide the same empathy towards you in exchange, you have brought that empathetic listening, that willingness to engage, that attempt to build a relationship, to be productive, and make positive change. And there was one story about having to listen to someone who was clearly not lending that empathy or respect towards you, asking for that person to look you in the eye and them choosing not to do so. And that's, I think, probably just one of many examples of that sort of thing that you've faced. And we'd love to have you talk a little bit about that approach that you take in empathetic leadership.
Well, yeah, thanks for that question, because, you know, as one of the very few trans elected officials, I take a lot of brunt of a lot of the rhetoric and the name calling and the misinformation and all the different things that they try to paint us with a broad brush, that the trans community is the way that they would like people to see us as. So for me, I have to be on point all the time. I have to set an example. I have to be the example. I have to take the high road, even when I'd like to say some different things, but it's not appropriate. And I'm giving them what they want when I do that. So I have to take a step back, take a deep breath, think about the right words, the right way to say it that makes the things that they have to say small. And the things that I want to say are saying, like, wow, you know, I'm trying to do good work for the people, and all you seem to do is just try to diminish me. And I don't see how that's helping the people that we serve. And it's hard, because I have to walk a tightrope. You know, I have to make sure that when I say things, I don't say something they're going to replay over and over again, that I'm not in a photo with somebody who that they want to attach to and say like, aha, we've got you. You know, they're always, it's always like, I'm always looking over my shoulder to make sure that they're not trying to like get me. And that's how it feels all the time. So I just try to take the high road and really just work with them and try to give them the benefit of the doubt. There's a lot of people that I've met in different places that have had, you know, things to say like, well, I don't feel comfortable with you being in the bathroom with me. And this happened at a class I was taking last summer. And my classmate sat down next to me to tell me that. And, you know, I thought about all the responses I could have had in that situation. And, you know, I didn't have a lot of time to think. So I took the approach of asking questions and finding out why. And we had a conversation about it. And, you know, it was a calm, civil conversation and with genuine curiosity about, well, why do you feel that way? Why do you think that? Is it a fear that you have? Like, I was really just trying to really understand it, because it didn't make sense to me as to why someone would feel that way. Because I haven't come across as someone who might be, you know, creepy or out to get anybody. Like, that's not my MO. So that conversation, you know, led to a conversation of empathy. And the woman who's talked to me, she was a Black woman who's a mayor of a town in Michigan. And, you know, she wouldn't think that we have a lot in common with the way we were discriminated against, but it's absolutely true. You know, we both have to deal with our identity when we walk in a door. And, you know, if people know that I'm trans, and as soon as I open my mouth, usually people do, and she walks in a room and she's a Black woman, like, everybody knows she's a Black woman when she walks in the door, and there's immediate judgments about who we are, what we're about, and what we stand for, and what they think we are. And when I pointed that out to her, she kind of like paused, and really the wheels started turning. She started to understand, like, maybe I do need to look at this in a little different way. And she had a moment of growth because of that conversation. But, you know, I know a lot of people that would have approached it and said like, oh, okay, yeah, whatever, bye, you know, and moved along and just sat at a different table or something and didn't, or took a hostile approach. But I know that most people don't feel hostile about this stuff. They've been told things, they've been fed a lot of lies about fear about these things. And having a conversation with someone who's the subject of that and give them a counterpoint was a really poignant way to do it. So I try to do that every chance I can get, but I know some people I can't reach. And I just find ways of putting them on the spot in different ways through policy and say, okay, well, you don't have to support my bill, but if you don't, your constituents are going to hate you for it. So you can either support my bill or hear from your constituents. And it's kind of sneaky stuff like that, that, you know, is how I can push their buttons a little bit without having to go low and insult and do the things that they like to do.
You touched on a lot of leadership qualities in that description. And I think one that we hear about so often is that ability to take a step back, to take that breath and gain a little perspective and a little time to think before responding that so many others don't. And we're going to explore some of that. But on Forge and Fire, what we really like to do with our guests is understand how you got to this point and how you became the leader that you are. And you and I are from a very similar generation, having grown up in the 80s and 90s, you know, and often that first exposure to trans people in our generation was from daytime talk shows. You know, for me, it was, you're homesick from school and Geraldo comes on and it's a bunch of trans women. And like, oh my goodness, you know, is that me? You know, and I understand you had a similar experience. How did that shape your expectations for yourself and your future?
Yeah, well, it's exactly it. And the only difference was the Phil Donahue show. And I was very confused about how I felt inside and what it meant. There was no internet back then. The library was not down the street from me. I lived in a rural area. It was hard to get information. So I saw the Phil Donahue show. He had guests that were trans women who had wives or significant others who were women. And I was like, what? Like, that's a possibility? Like, that could happen? And it was so intriguing. And I was only like 7 or 8 or something like that when I saw it. I guess my mom wasn't watching what was on the TV either. But it really got my brain moving about it, but I didn't know what to do with it. I didn't know. I had no idea. It was just like a very intriguing thought. And, you know, as I started to grow up and there was, it was a small town and there were there were really no gay people in my town because it was hard to be out as being gay. And, you know, you knew the people who were suspected to be gay because everybody was talking behind their back. It was just that kind of environment. So, you know, any thought that I had about me being different was very sheltered and very guarded. And I wouldn't tell anyone. I couldn't even tell my parents about anything. So, you know, you see Ace Ventura, Pet Detective, these blockbuster movies that, you know, you go with your friends to see. And then, you know, you get to the ending. And if you haven't seen it, spoiler alert. One of the characters is trans, and then there's this visceral reaction that happens. And, you know, I'm in the theater, my friends are laughing. What am I supposed to do? Not laugh? No, I had to put up the show to say, this doesn't bother me. Yeah, this is funny. Ha ha ha. And, you know, inside I'm just, you know, shrinking, you know, and it just destroys you. And it was really hard. I was so afraid of losing friends and family, especially in a small town environment, that I told very few people and only admitted I was even a crossdresser because that was as far as I was willing to admit for a while. And it wasn't until I started to see some therapists and they weren't even very helpful because many therapists weren't trained in how to talk to somebody with gender dysphoria and they dismissed it. And they said, oh no, no, you can't be that. Oh no, no. And it was just like, I'm trying to like open up to you about this and you don't want to talk about it. It was a really frustrating experience, but I wanted this job. I wanted this job of being an FBI special agent. That's what I really wanted to do. And I always like kept a very low profile. I never had a social media account for a long time. And I just said, I'm going to dedicate my life to this job. This is what I want to do. I want to help. I want to serve the community. I want to do this stuff. And I'm going to just try to keep this secret away from even them. Even with a polygraph, was a very scary thing to think about. But when I didn't get the job, that was the turning point for me. That was the point where I said, I can't do this anymore. I can't distract myself with this job and put 90 hours a week into this job to distract myself from myself anymore. That's not a possibility. So what am I going to do now? And that's when I realized that it was time for me to start thinking about myself. And that's when I started to come out as being trans. And I talked to the right people who could help me. And I was so fortunate to be in Colorado because in Colorado, even when I moved here and several years later, it was actually a state that was going in the right direction. I had come from New York New York is also in a good place now, but had I gone anywhere else, I don't even know if I could have come out, because I don't know if I would have had the network. I wouldn't have found the people who were more like me, who were more open, because when the environment offers people to be themselves without judgment, there's more people being themselves without judgment. When you're in a place where you're judged for who you are, there's less people and the community is smaller. That doesn't mean the community is really smaller. It's just visibly smaller. So I was really fortunate to be here in Colorado to be able to find people who gave me the courage to say, we like you who you are, as you are, and come and hang out and show up any way you want because we like you.
It's remarkable to me the length of time in your life where you were in that space where you were hiding, you were actively keeping a low profile in your personal life. You were looking at a professional life that would essentially allow you to hide and have this additional layer that would keep you in that space. And even from the time of being a child and having that experience of feeling like you were shrinking inside. And then having a later phase in your life where you were surrounded by people who were being open and you were in an environment that was allowing for that. And then, of course, you came to be an advocate yourself and do a tremendous amount of work progressing that forward even further. And I'm wondering about that dichotomy. And as you reflect on that and that shift that occurred, how did that augment your leadership journey? What was it that added to your ability to take on some of the things that you've taken on since that time?
I've always been the kind of person that when someone offers me to go do something, I say yes. I was usually like the person that said yes a lot. I wasn't the person who did a lot of things, but I did a lot of things because people asked me to do it. And I was often pretty good at it. So, hey, let's go rock climbing. Okay. You know, like, all right, let's try that. You know, let's go do this. Hey, we're going to go jump off this bridge, which I actually did. I jumped off a bridge. It was into a reservoir. It was like 30 feet high. It wasn't like really big, tall bridge. But it was like, you know, I said yes. I got a lot of experiences. I traveled across the country and started working when I was 14 years old. You know, I had a job. I was paying Social Security. And it was, you know, I think a lot of, you know, my work ethic came from my parents and my grandfather, who was an immigrant who made it from nothing, from a poor community in Sicily, who came over and worked really hard, and he started a business, and he grew the business, and he got to travel, and he wrote a book about it, and I always just asked a lot of questions because I looked to him as a leader, and he was, because he, without even an education, he was a leader in his business. And he was, I mean, his business grew to an enormous size. He was one of the largest bakeries in the Northeast at one point back in the 80s. And that was because he was a leader. And I learned a lot about how to work with other people. You know, when I started working at my job, he was, you know, I was like, well, you know, if you're going to be leading people, you have to, you can't treat them badly. You have to encourage them. And he kind of gave me a lot of opportunities to grow at an early age and learn a lot of these pretty, you know, now I think leadership techniques are pretty basic, but I kind of learned them at an early age and honed them. And I worked a lot managing small groups of people. And I found ways of getting them to do things even when they didn't want to do them. And it was really by being nice to them. And I found that, you know, the old adage that you draw more flies with honey than vinegar is really true. And when you treat people well and you treat people right and you're honest with them and they trust you and they respect you, you get so much more done. And when I started out as a geologist, I had small drilling crews, and we got a lot done. We we had a good relationship. We joked around. We had, you know, we tried to, I really tried to reach people at a personal level and start a bond with them. Even if they didn't, I didn't agree with what they were saying. You know, I was good at pretending that I thought some things were funny even when they weren't. But sometimes you just have to do that, and you have to establish that. It was a lot of the work I did after that. When I traveled for mining, I was traveling to different countries and working with people of different cultures and very challenging environments and language barriers. And, you know, I further got to hone a lot of those skills of communicating with people in different ways and understanding when people are struggling and giving them time to say, hey, look, it's okay. Well, this is a problem. I get it. Don't panic. We'll fix it. We'll make it right. And they were like, you know, once the crisis was over, they're like, thank you. I was freaking out. And because you were calm and you got me to be able to handle the situation because you gave me that ability to see that it was okay. And now that I'm in the legislature, it's very similar to my consulting work, because I would get sent away to some foreign country working with a group of people for 3 to 5 weeks at a time. And these are the people you're stuck with, and you have to do the work and you have to get it done. And there's no excuses. You can't, you know, say, I'm not working with you. You have to. And the legislature is very similar. We have a 120-day session. We go down there, we do work, we work together. We don't disagree, we disagree with each other all the time, but we still have a job to do and to get it done. So I really pulled a lot of that, like all the way through from my teenage years, and those things that I picked up and the questions I asked all along the way, all the way to the legislature, and was able to apply all of that. And that's why I was elected to a leadership position in the House. And I just have a different style. I don't make it about myself. I make it about what we're trying to accomplish. And in the legislature, not everybody's trying to do that. You have a lot of people who are out for their own selfish interests a lot of times. And you still have to work with them. You can't throw them under the bus without having some ramifications to that. So you have to be really careful and really just think and say, what is there another way? And it's not to say that I haven't made mistakes and said things in the heat of passion that I shouldn't have. Of course, I think everybody does, but we go back and we learn about those things. We lick our wounds and we come back the next time and say, I'm not going to be angry. That's too easy. Let's think of a different way where I can get the result that I want and do it in a way that doesn't make everybody angry, and we can still accomplish it without causing turmoil. And it's been an evolution for me to learn a lot of these skills, but I make a lot of mistakes and I learn from them. And I think that's the best way any leader can do the work that they do, is to make mistakes and do better the next time. And there will always be a next time.
So it sounds like through your developmental journey, there were almost what appeared to be two parallel tracks, one of which was discovering the self and who you really were. And the other was this leadership journey through other fields and listening and learning from others. And though I'm sure there were myriad interconnected pieces along the way, where perhaps it all seemed to come together was when you decided to run for office and you had that first opportunity to be authentic and be yourself in a leadership role. And my understanding, you deliberately communicated your authenticity to your constituents in your first campaign to talk about the elephant that might be in the room and the one in the district. How did you do that? And why was it so important for you to communicate your authenticity?
So I was an activist when I came out, and I said, well, I wanted to do a job that was doing things for the community. So why not do things for the community that I'm now part of that needs help? So it was a logical way for me to step up. I was a volunteer firefighter when I was a teenager. I stepped up when the occasion arose. I wanted to be in the military. I wanted to many times, and I never got the chance because I was afraid of my secret not being able to give myself what I needed in an environment where everybody was all in your business all the time. But it was important for me to just tell people who I was up front, because I was really in the beginning of my transition, and I was going through voice therapy to try to speak in a different way that made me blend in more, made me more passing. And it was always like a really important thing, because I wanted to avoid people harassing me. I wanted to, you know, not have to deal with people asking uncomfortable questions. And the more that I could do that, that would be better. But when the occasion came around to run for office, I wasn't ready. I hadn't done enough, and I wasn't there yet. And when you're a politician, you talk a lot. And if I can talk in a different register and it trails off over time, I'm talking like a different person at the end of the conversation, because it's hard to, when you're not trained enough, you can't do it. So I had to make a decision whether I was going to run for office as me with the voice that I have, the way that I am, or was I going to wait and then do it when I felt more comfortable in speaking in the way that I felt like I could. The opportunity wasn't going to wait for me, so I had to jump on it. And I said, well, I'll just be who I am, that's the way I am. And instead of the sound of my voice, it'll be the substance of my words that will really matter. And as you alluded to, the first speech I gave was at the caucus for the Democratic nomination. I was the only one being nominated, but I still had to address the people. And I said, you know, hi, I'm Brianna Titone. I'm running for House District 27. Let me address the elephant in the room. I'm a trans person. Now that that's out of the way, let's address the elephant in the district and how we can win against this guy and put a Democrat in that spot. And it was an icebreaker. It was like a little joke, and it got it out of the way, because in my mind, I was like, I don't want people looking at me and scratching their head and talking to their neighbor. Like, what's with the voice there? What's going on here? Is that a trans person? Like, I didn't want that distracting people, because I had more to say after that. And I want you to listen to it. So now that that's out of the way, let's listen to the policy stuff. And I went to the doors, and I didn't say, hey, I'm Brianna, I'm a trans person, I'm running for office. Like, it wasn't that. It was, I'm running for office because I think you deserve better in this position. And you haven't been served, and I want to know what's on your mind and how I can do the better job that you really have been missing out on. And people resonated with that. And showing up, which nobody had before, was a big deal. I mean, I already just did a lot more just by knocking on the door to begin with. And most of the time, nobody even blinked an eye about me being a trans person or even asked. I had a few people who were rude. I've had a few people that asked like off-color questions, but some of them didn't do it in a negative way. It was just they didn't know how to ask proper questions. And I didn't get mad at them. I chuckled a little bit because they were, you know, like, oh, wow, you really don't know anything. But that's okay. I'm here to help you. And that one particular guy I ran into after I was elected in my new district in this last election. And he said, oh, hey, yeah, remember we were talking at my house that one day, and you've been doing a great job. And it wasn't about anything else. And that's what I always tell everybody, even the Republicans. I tell the Republicans this too. If you do a good job and you represent everybody and you really care about as many people as you can, like, I have an agenda about the policies I want to do, but it's not, you know, it's not like I'm trying to get anybody. If you just do the job, you show up, you listen to people, you respond to people, you know, this one guy would always say, oh, here, I'm going to challenge you with this question. And, you know, the first time he didn't think I was going to write back. And then I did. So then we had this back and forth all the time. And he always disagreed with me. But we had, you know, good little email back and forths. And when he wasn't my constituent anymore with redistricting, he got upset about it. He's like, wait a minute, you're not my representative anymore? It's like, he's like, what am I going to do? So, you know, it's like, it's we're all human beings and we respond to things in the same ways, the same reward systems, you know, psychology 101. And we just do more of that. If we all just did more of that, I think we could all have a little bit better world and didn't get stuck in our agenda too much and have a little bit more flexibility.
You know, it may be psychology 101, but we know so many people do not approach their challenges and their interactions with others in that way. And I think that story really exemplifies a deep understanding of how people tick and how you can reach them. And so the example of using the elephant in the room in the speech, you know, it's more than just bringing a bit of humor in and winning over the audience with a joke and being authentic. It's also leveraging something that really could have put you in a difficult position, that you knew there were going to be attitudes toward that and reactions towards that that were not positive. And then turning that into a strength. And that's something that inspirational leaders do. They turn things that could be perceived as weaknesses into strengths. And you've talked about some things, for example, like ADHD that you use to connect and inspire people. And certainly many of the things that you've done in the LGBTQ space have also worked with the perceptions that exist, which are oftentimes negative, and then flipped that and really, that again, understanding how people think and how you can make a connection with them where they're at, even if where they're at is very, very different from where you would ultimately like them to be. How have you done that? And how have you been effective in shifting those things into strengths or leverage points for your career?
I think the, you know, I mentioned about my ADHD because in a sense, I've kind of used it as an asset because I'm always into something. I'm always learning something. I always want to, like, ooh, shiny thing. What's that? Ooh. And it's really piques my curiosity. And I'm just like a really interested in learning stuff. And I think also, you know, there's a lot of people these days who have ADHD and think that it holds them back. And it's considered a learning disability. And what I found out when I diagnosed it myself and got it, a psychologist to confirm that, I was like, I don't want a learning disability. Whoa, wait a minute. Like, everybody says I'm smart. How could that be? It was hard. It was hard for me to accept, but then I embraced it and figured out how to do things differently, to learn better and to retain things. And when I tell groups of people, especially young people, that I have ADHD, and they say, oh, wow, okay, you're a trans person and you have ADHD. And I'm that person too. And I can see somebody who's more like me in that, doing something cool that I respect. And that helps to inspire people to want to do more when they see more people like them. What was the other part of your question? Because I had something else I was going to say, and it was really good, and my ADHD got me off track.
Well, that's perfect. But I was curious, especially in your work in the LGBTQ space, how you've leveraged that.
Yes, yes. Actually, yeah, I had a really good example that, so a friend of mine came up to me and said, I want to show you these photos. And she was involved with sex work and she had a client, and that client beat her significantly, and she was bruised everywhere, and she wanted to show me a picture of how bruised she was, because there wasn't a space that wasn't. She was brutalized. And she said, "What can we do to prevent this from happening? Because when the guy beat me up, he said, 'Who are you going to tell? You're doing something illegal too, and you're going to go to jail.'" And that statement made her afraid to go get help, to call someone, to call the police, to arrest that person who did a very heinous crime. And she said, "How do we fix this?" And she said that she had talked to two other legislators before me about it in the past year, and nobody would touch it. And I said, "Well, let me have a couple conversations with some people who are in that space, a couple of the DAs who I knew who were more progressive." And I said, "Can we come up with a plan to figure this out?" And, you know, protecting sex workers is not exactly a topic that a lot of people want to do. And if you're adamantly against sex work, you don't want to vote for something like that. So I had to be strategic and think about this issue more holistically about what the problem we wanted to really solve was. So I framed it in a way of saying, we're trying to put people doing violent crimes in jail. These are people who are preying on people. These are people that in history, people who prey on sex workers go on to be serial killers. And they bring that violence home to their spouses and their kids. And how can we stop them from having an arena where they practice their violence? And I looped in sex trafficking victims as well, because I knew that would resonate with the other side of the aisle. They talked about sex trafficking a lot. And I said, "Well, we're going to help sex trafficking victims." And, you know, in my mind, you know, I was trying to protect a lot of trans people. Black trans women resort to sex work a lot, and they get beat up a lot. And we had another friend of mine who came and testified about that. And when she did go to the police, they questioned her about why she was there, not about what the crime was. And having the immunity for the prostitution charge empowers people to say, "I'm not going to take this violence. And if you do anything, I can speak out and I will get you in trouble and I can protect myself." And so we developed this bill late, and I had to ask permission for a late bill from the speaker. And the speaker looked at the title and he said, "This is an election year. What's wrong with you? You're trying to run a sex worker bill. Are you out of your mind?" And I said, "Don't worry. I've got it all figured out. I know who's going to be in this. I have a Republican who's going to sponsor it with me in the House and in the Senate." And the bill got 100% of the vote. Every single person, 100 out of 100 people voted yes on that bill. And that was like, you know, I had to go back to the speaker and like, you know, "Hey, I think you owe me an apology. And, you know, because I kind of told you so and you didn't believe me." And he goes, "All right, yeah, you were right. That was a good bill."
I think that pulls together so many of the things that are important to leaders, particularly in our community, where it is so much about lifting up the most vulnerable and making sure everyone has the opportunity to flourish and to succeed. Now, you did mention earlier that you had that moment where you knew that opportunity wasn't going to wait for you. And for a lot of LGBTQ youth and even adults, there's that fear that now isn't the time. Now isn't the time for me to be out there, to put myself out, make myself vulnerable, even though I have an opportunity in front of me. What advice would you have, or stories that you might want to share that inspire others to say, yes, seize that opportunity. Your authenticity is valuable. We need you along with us.
Well, I mean, it wasn't my voice that was the only thing that gave me a little apprehension about running in that district, because that district that I ran in the first time, the Republicans would win by double digits. And the last election before mine, the Republican won by 14%, which was over 7,000 votes. Now, keep in mind, this district is educated, it's wealthy, and it's white, and it's old. So all of the people vote, and 90% turnout of active voters is very common. So when you have a 14% deficit, you have to get those people to vote for you because they're going to vote. So when I said, oh, yeah, I'll run for that, you know, I looked at the numbers, and in the 2016 election, although the Republican won by 14%, Hillary Clinton did win by 12 votes. Not 12%. She won by 12 votes. But I said, well, that's 11 more than I need. So there's enough people that will vote for a Democrat in the district if I can get to them and convince them. But that wasn't enough for the Democrats to support me, really. They didn't really do that much. Advocacy groups didn't do that much. Donors didn't give that much. It was hard because they said, your race is impossible. You're a Democrat and you're a trans person. So now, like, being a Democrat made your chances nil, and now it's even worse. But that didn't dissuade me from doing it because I was inspired by Danica Rome winning her election in 2017. And she won by a healthy margin. She flipped the district. I naively thought that because she had won that I would get a whole bunch of support coming towards me because I was going to do this too. But nobody knew who I was. I didn't have the connections. I was literally an unknown person when I ran for office the first time. It was really just listening to my trusted people about what I should do and then just doing it and following through. And sometimes you just do the things you got to do and it ends up working out. And you have to go above and beyond. And I knew that I had to. I knew I had to do extra. I knew I had to do more. We didn't have the money, so we had to design our own lit. We didn't have the money. We had to do our digital ads ourselves. We had to do everything. And we just did it. And we didn't complain about it. We didn't whine about it. We just said, this has to be done, and we're going to do it, and we're going to win. And that's what we did. And it surprised a lot of people. And even when I was elected, people didn't think that I belonged there and didn't know that I was going to amount to anything. And, they didn't know who I was. And I get it. If I didn't know who somebody was either, I would have my doubts for sure. So it took a long time for me to really get people to say, yeah, you're a really good legislator. And this is a funny thing. Like, recently the lobbyists have been spreading this rumor that I'm like trying to overthrow the Speaker of the House and take over the Speaker's position, which is so far from the truth. I'm not doing that at all. But for them to say that really shows there's a perception that I have a lot of power. And that's a pretty exciting thing to see, that people think that I could do that. So I need to make sure that I'm applying the leverage and flipping the levers where I need to, because I actually have more power in that building than I even thought of myself, because I try to be humble about it. I don't try to throw my weight around, but it seems like I could if I wanted to, but I'm not overthrowing the speaker. just to be clear.
But what you are doing, which I think is remarkable, is looking at something where you're being attacked and they're trying to create something negative with this narrative, and you are noticing what's positive within that and seeing the potential within that and then wanting to use that for good. And you have done that time and time again. You've had so many legislative wins that have expanded opportunities and rights for individuals. And so it is clearly paid off, and it has paid off for so much more than you. And yet, despite that, you posed a question to us that we really wanted to explore with you, which is, despite the progress and the demonstration of success of you and many, many other leaders like you, why do LGBTQ leaders still get thought of last? What is that they get dismissed or not considered as leaders despite all of that progress? And, you know, we could talk about there being very small numbers proportionally. We could talk about it's a generational thing, which eventually will phase out. And certainly the inherent biases and prejudices that exist. But what is it that you think it is? And what have you learned about that dynamic in your time in this work?
Well, I think that, you know, because this country of ours is so divided right now on LGBT topics, you know, half of the states are going in the opposite direction and the other half are going in a better direction, that, you know, it's some kind of tragedy, it's some kind of travesty, something that happens that's negative that gets the media's attention. And that's where they focus their attention on. And, you know, sometimes like we need to, you know, when Zoe Zephyr in Montana was, you know, not allowed to be back in the chamber, like that definitely needed to be covered. And that definitely needed to show the hypocrisy of a ruling power that did not want to hear opposition to their ways of thinking. But, you know, I'm in Colorado. I'm a policy wonk. Policy's not sexy. It's not like, it's not something that people want to talk about that much. Like I try to generate bills that get media attention, and I do. Human composting, right to repair, my hydrogen bill, first in the nation, mental health care for everyone for a mental health wellness exam, no matter what insurance you have. There's been a lot of things that we've done that are in the forefront of things, but policy, it's not what sells. And, you know, you alluded to an article that you read. It was a Washington Post article, and that author reached out to me after the Club Q shooting. And she said, everybody is always like, wants to talk to people who are leaders in the LGBT community after a tragedy and get a response. But we can't just keep printing articles about tragedy. What can we do to actually show people what's more and like look under the hood and see what's really running the engine here? And we were brainstorming. I was trying to help her figure out some different story ideas. And she asked me about me. She's like, why don't we just write an article about you? And I was like, I wasn't trying to get you to do that. But I mean, if that's what you want to do, like, I'll help you with that. And, you know, she's a great writer. Casey Parks is her name. And she's a great writer. And she wrote a great article that really, and she got to witness a lot of the things that happened and the conversations that happened with Republicans in very difficult conversations. And she was actually there. So she really got to see how I work in action. And it wasn't an act. It was just an authentic conversation. And she was sitting in the background. It was kind of bizarre in a way. But it really got to tell that story. And I'm sure there's so many other people who have similar stories and they're not being told. And that's a shame because there's so much good work going on all over the place in all different levels of government and in companies and everything. But nobody wants to talk about it and print it or record it because it's not the sexy stuff that sells. And the stories don't get told. And that's a shame because I view my work as having two jobs. I'm a legislator and I'm also, you know, a pioneering trans person who is in an office ahead of a lot of people. And I'm an inspirational figure. And that's another job to do that, to show up to the rallies, to show up to DEI things and talk to companies at Pride Month and to give them like all the different stuff. But I do that because I have term limits and I can't do this job that much anyway, but I want to do the most good. And the more people that hear the stories, the more people that can, you know, see me down the street and, you know, have a conversation with me because they recognize me and they want to know more. All those little things really add up. And when you touch one life and you give someone hope, you give them a reason to want to go do something more or just walk out the door, you know, because so many trans people don't even want to walk out the door because of the way they perceive everything. I want people to empower themselves to be able to do that. And the more that I can get people to know about what I'm doing and so many of the other people who are doing a lot of really great work too. I'm not the only one. The more everybody knows about them, the more a lot of people benefit. It's a domino effect. And that's what's really important to me in the role that I have.
Well, you hit on so many of the reasons why we have this show. It's to tell those inspirational stories, not to respond to tragedy, but to show how people who, despite the barriers that were in front of them, use them as moments to develop and to be inspirational leaders and create that virtuous chain of one to another to many more in the future, and to not have the future be a place where LGBTQ leaders are dismissed. You know, you mentioned your inspiration from Danica Rome, and then we can think about all the others that have drawn inspiration from you and what's coming next. You know, will we have Sarah McBride as the first trans woman in Congress next year? And to see these things come together, I think we're going to see that change. And you have been a huge part in making that happen. So, Brianna Tatone, thank you so much for joining us on Forged in Fire. It has been an absolute pleasure to have you.
It's been a lot of fun. Thank you so much. So let's do this again.
Thank you for listening to this episode. Forged in Fire is hosted by Bree Fram and Liz Cavallero. Produced and engineered by Frida Castellanos and Christina George. Guest management by Trey Worth and original music by Bridget Benemark. The views and ideas expressed by the hosts and guests of this podcast are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of the organizations or institutions they represent. To learn more about Forged in Fire, please visit us at forgedinfire.org.